From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Dreams of cornucopia weren't just a thing of fairy tales in the past. Well into the late 20th century, the Soviet government trumpeted abundance to create an illusion of material well-being. Shop windows featured artfully arranged displays of canned goods that concealed the empty shelves inside. Moscow's handful of fancy restaurants triumphantly presented diners with oversized leather-bound menus, listing dozens of dishes when only a handful were ever available from the kitchen. The nightly news broadcasts ended with images of plentiful harvests playing across the screen, with wheat pouring through hoppers like waterfalls of golden grain. No matter that the government was often forced to import wheat from its political enemies to make sure that there would be enough cattle fodder and bread. Foodstuffs randomly appeared and disappeared, and shopping took real talent. Even when virtually nothing seemed to be available, almost everything could be had if you knew how to obtain it. And obtain it people did, putting together some of the most elaborate meals I've ever enjoyed. Food shortages being a catalyst for creativity.
That was celebrated food scholar Dara Goldstein reading from her latest book, The Kingdom of Rye, A Brief History of Russian Food. Her grandparents fled the country and refused to discuss it with her, but that only piqued her interest. Her first opportunity to visit came in 1972. Ever since, she's made it her life's work to explore the foods and flavors of a country that is front and center in the news right now. Hi, Dara.
Hi, Evan.
One of the things that struck me when I read that paragraph was this idea of truthiness. It's been several months since Russia invaded Ukraine. I'm curious about what you are thinking of these days.
Oh, Evan, I mean, I'm in despair. I feel deep anguish. I think what Putin did and is doing took even political analysts by surprise. And the brutality of the war is beyond horrific. I think about what's happening in Ukraine, but I also think about my friends in Russia. Just before social media was shut down, I got frantic messages from friends. They wanted to make sure that we could remain in touch. But they also, one closest friend really said, we've been thrown back to the Middle Ages. Russia has completely isolated itself and its people. There have been tens of thousands of arrests. It's not on the same scale as what's happening in Ukraine, but it's also really, really bad there.
Yeah, there's so many layers, so many layers. So I'm always fascinated by people who come to a love of exploring food deeply through literature, since I feel like that happened to me as well. How did studying the Russian language spark your interest in Russian food?
I struggled with the language. It's complex. The grammar is pretty difficult. And when I was first studying it, it was very different than language study now, which is oral proficiency. Then we just read texts. But the texts we were given were Chekhov, they were Gogol, these 19th century authors who described amazing feasts. And somehow, and I still don't quite understand how it happened, but I would understand just enough to somehow breeze through the descriptions of food, not really understanding every word, but getting this feel for the abundance and for the deliciousness. And then I would go back and look up the words in the dictionary.
So fascinating. There are two Russian words for food. Can you describe them?
Yes. One is yeda, which comes from yeast, which is an interesting word in itself. It's a verb that either means to be or exist, or it means to eat. And the other word is pisha. And yada is just sort of a general word for food, and it can also mean a meal. So it's not symbolic of anything else. But if you talk about pisha, then it can be something metaphorical. It can be something higher, like, you know, food for thought or food of the gods. It's something that is more than just the food stuff on the plate.
There's this thread in Russian food lore of privation and abundance. And the privation part is so linked to the brown bread. You have this amazing excerpt at the beginning of your first chapter from Anna Karenina talking about an old man who makes, in essence, a bread parfait. It's bread on bread in a cup.
You know, when we talk about being hungry, or people who are really struggling to get enough to eat, we say from hand to mouth in English, but the Russian phrase is from bread to kvass. Kvass being the lightly fermented drink that is made from stale black bread. So bread was used. I mean, it was never wasted. Even the crumbs were turned into desserts. Countess Tolstoy, the long-suffering wife of Lev Tolstoy, wrote a cookbook, and she has a beautiful recipe for an apple pudding made with leftover breadcrumbs.
Also embodied in this history of famine and privation is this deep well of culinary ingenuity. You've written books in which you talk about fermentation and culturing in great detail, particularly in your last book, where you explore the food of the far north of Russia. Is there a particular experience that you remember having during those first years that you were traveling where you ate something fermented or cured and were just flabbergasted?
I think that what struck me was I had never liked mushrooms. I think it's probably because I grew up in Pittsburgh. And even though I'm sure that there were amazing mushrooms to forage in the 1950s, we weren't going out and foraging them. So my parents really liked mushrooms, but they were always those horrible canned ones that to me were just slimy and disgusting. So I thought I hated mushrooms. And then I went to the Soviet Union and I tasted freshly gathered mushrooms that were simply sautéed, but more to what you're talking about, the fermentation. I tasted them salted. They had been layered with garlic, with some dill, some peppercorns, and salt brine, and they were extraordinary. It was really a transformative moment for me.
You know, it's interesting for me. As an Ashkenazi Jew, our food is often characterized by being brown and bland. And as you talk about the food of Russia in this book, one becomes so aware of the high notes, the sourness, the pungency, the spiciness. It just is all a different color.
It is. And that's what makes it so exciting to me. You have horseradish, you have beets, you have very pungent mustard, you have vinegar. All of these things that, even though it's not a spicy cuisine, it's very pungent and sharp.
Yeah, sharpness is really a theme. So what is at the heart of a traditional Russian meal? And what does that even mean to you, traditional Russian meal? And is it bifurcated by class?
Yeah, it's definitely bifurcated. I mean, when I think of the heart of a Russian meal, I think I would go to bread and soup, or perhaps the Russian saying, shchida kasha, pishcha nasha, cabbage soup and buckwheat groats, that's our fare. So it would be soup in a big communal pot, The Russian national soup is cabbage soup, preferably made with sauerkraut, the fermented cabbage. If you make it with fresh cabbage, then it's called lazy cabbage soup, and it's not nearly as good. But then you have the starch, and preferably black bread or buckwheat groats. But actually, what I think is the glory of the Russian kitchen is its pies. And very rarely would you have soup without some sort of pie on the side, whether it's a little hand pie, the pirozhki, or vatrushki, which are a personal favorite of mine. They're open-faced pies that are filled with farmer's cheese. Or you can have a grand pie like the kulibyaka, the fish pie that I mentioned, or so many others. And again, I keep coming back to these sayings. The house is beautiful, not for its walls, but for its pies.
So the title of your book is The Kingdom of Rye. Explain the reverence of rye.
In Russian, it's actually the Tsardom of Rye, but I didn't think that that had the right ring in English. Rye is so interesting because it actually was a weed that was growing in Southwest Asia. People noticed that it was much hardier. And it came to Russia probably in the mid-10th century and was pretty well established by the 11th century. And because it's much hardier than wheat and can withstand poor soil and also a much colder climate, it became the grain in Russia.
Thank you so much, Dara.
Thank you, Evan.
Dara Goldstein is a professor emerita of Russian studies at Williams College and the founding editor of Gastronomica, the Journal of Food Studies. Her latest book, The Kingdom of Rye, A Brief History of Russian Food, came out in May of this year. Coming up, teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. Teach a man to teach his kids to fish and he must grapple with the environmental consequences of his hobby.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Each summer, angler and writer Paul Greenberg reflects on fishing with his father, an activity he loved. He's also an advocate for the environment and seafood sustainability, forcing him to rethink one of his favorite father-child activities. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Evan, how are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you back.
Great to be here.
Could you share with us some of your earliest memories of fishing with your father?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my dad was a kind of classic 70s era divorcee. When he suddenly found himself with children on his hand on a weekend, not knowing what the heck to do with us, he found fishing. And I think as I wrote in my piece in Medium, he fell upon fishing like a man in the desert upon an oasis. Because suddenly here was this opportunity to burn 5 to 8 hours on the sea. We started fishing quite a bit on what are called party boats here in Long Island. I think on the West Coast, they call them maybe open boats. And we would go out in these very sort of kind of scrappy, dingy boats with pretty marginal people oftentimes aboard. My dad would often sit at the front of the boat and play poker on the hour or so ride to the grounds. And then, you know, we would find ourselves sitting next to each other fishing all day long and really running out of excuses not to talk to each other. So there was a lot of fishing, but there was a lot of talking, and we just shared a lot during those times.
And how old were you when you first went out on the boat with him?
Well, I think I must have been about 6. I always remember when I was 3, he took my brother out. I was too young. And I remember the boat coming in and my brother and my father at the front of the boat and my father signaling two fish. And I was so angry and so obsessed with not being left behind the next time.
And what did you usually end up doing with your catch?
Well, so that was complicated. You know, when you fish, there is this moment. There's, of course, a lot of waiting in fishing, and some days are much worse than others. But on the good days, you start catching with abandon, and the fish suddenly just seem to arrive from everywhere. And it kicks off some sort of kind of primordial instinct in you to just not stop. And so we would catch and catch and catch. And sometimes when we were going out for fish, like, say, Atlantic mackerel or bluefish, which are both can be very, very abundant. You catch a lot of them, 10, 20 fish, not uncommon. But at the same time, both mackerel and bluefish spoil very quickly. So it was not uncommon for us to waste our catch, I have to admit. Sometimes it would end up in the garden, sometimes it would go to the cat. We'd always eat some, but I was never properly planning for cooking my catch when I went out there. And you know, if I can fault my father for one thing in my fishing education, it was that there wasn't too much thought being put into what we would do with our catch after we caught it.
Can you talk a little bit about how this activity of fishing is more than just about learning the basics of casting a rod and hooking bait for kids?
Yeah, you know, for me, fishing is this unique way of kind of stepping into an ecosystem. There are a lot of people, of course, who just like to watch birds or count trees. But when you're fishing, you are a predator, and you're a predator at the top of the food chain. And in order to be a predator, you have to be highly, highly observant. You have to understand where in the course of a tide cycle fish are most apt to bite. You have to understand how a fish sees the world, why a sunset or a sunrise causes predators to have an advantage over prey, and that they're able to kind of find out prey fish in a way in those lighting situations that are not the typical lighting situations. I guess I think more than anything else, you start to understand the sort of energistics of prey-predator relationships. A predator often tries to expend as little energy as possible in accruing the biggest prey possible. So when you kind of get that predator-prey equation into your mind, you try to decode it in a number of different situations. Understanding the way that fish pursue your lure or your bait is a key, key window into the way ecosystems work.
How has the act of fishing itself changed from sort of the Mark Twain, Huck Finn times of a rusty hook on a knotted line to now?
Yeah, I mean, it really has changed quite a bit. I mean, I can remember being in a semi-Huck Finn situation when I first started fishing. Actually, I think my very first fishing experience on my own with a friend is we had bobby pins, yarn, and Gainsburgers that we threw into a pond. So that was really, really, really low tech. But, you know, in the last 40 to 50 years, there have been incredible advances in fishing technology. So sonar has gotten more and more specific in its ability to find where fish are. They're called fish finders, but they're actually very, very specific kinds of sonar that actually allow you to locate even an individual fish. So right there and then you have this kind of decloaking of this mysterious world, which gives you really an unfair advantage. There are all sorts of other technologies. There's a kind of line now called fluorocarbon. Scientists have looked at the vision of fish and understood how to create a line that is essentially invisible to a fish's eye. So overall, the deck is really stacked against fish. And yet, at the same time, we still maintain this kind of primitive Huck Finn sense in our minds that, oh, I'm just a guy with a hook out there. But really, when you look at the numbers out there, there are many fisheries today where sport fishermen actually kill more fish than commercial fishermen in the same bioregion.
Can you talk about trophy fish and their importance to endurance of species?
Well, you know, I think we have this obsession as humans with catching a really, really big fish. Those fish actually turn out to be critical to a species' survival. There's a funny quasi-biological term called a BOF, and BOF stands for a big, old, fat female fish. And BOFs turn out to not only produce many, many more eggs than younger, smaller fish, those eggs actually turn out to be substantially more viable and more likely to hatch. And so when you catch trophy fish and take them out of the spawning population, you're not just removing one more breeder from the population, you're removing a major breeder, a major contributor. Sport fishermen who specifically target and kill those boffs, those trophy fish, are doing a kind of multiplier effect damage on a stock.
So are there no regulations in place to protect those fish?
Well, increasingly there are. There weren't when I was a kid. We've started to see, I want to say the last 30 years, what are called slot limits. And slot limits mean that you're not allowed to catch fish below a certain size because you want to have every fish have an opportunity to spawn at least once. But on top of it, you're now not allowed to catch fish above a certain size. I'm not a great fan of catch and release fishing, and I know that's somewhat controversial.
And why is that?
Well, I think that it is justifiable to go out and hunt something and kill it and eat it, as long as you're going to eat the whole thing. But going out for a full day and catching and releasing and catching and releasing is frankly just torture. You know, a lot of anglers, when they speak about sport fish that they fought, they'll say things, well, I let him go to fight another day. And it makes it seem as if the sport fish in question is like equivalent in its desires and its life plan, when really it's not the case. You know, you have this animal that's swimming free. It has no idea what a human is doing out there. Suddenly, it's got a hook impaled in its jaw. It's fighting hard like crazy, fighting for its life, in fact. And then it gets brought aboard. It gets pulled out of the water. It gets touched. When you touch a fish's mucous membrane, you're quite likely to spread an infection and compromise its ability to survive. It gets held up to the light. Oftentimes, eyes are damaged by exposure to direct sunlight. And then it gets thrown back. Somewhere around 20-30% of the fish that are released will go on to die. So I don't really understand, and I don't really see the moral justification in doing that.
Can you talk about the notion of quiet observation and perhaps a better alternative to catch and release?
Yeah, I mean, so you've caught this fish, right? And say you've killed and you're done. I think it takes a bigger mind and a bigger heart and maybe more caution on the part of parents to teach their children this. But what about taking a moment to understand, geez, what was the ecosystem that produced this big, beautiful fish for me? There is real value in just pausing and looking and watching and considering.
Do you have children?
I do. I have a daughter who's lives over in Scotland and is a doctor, and I have a son who's here in New York and 15, and I fished with both of them and really enjoyed my time fishing with them.
Well, it was a wonderful essay and an even better conversation. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you so much, Evan. Great to be back on the show.
Paul Greenberg is the author of multiple books, including Four Fish, The Omega Principle, and The Climate Diet. We've been discussing the evolution of recreational fishing in our ever-changing world. Andy Baragani admits that he shied away from a career in the kitchen. Instead, he had pipe dreams of becoming the next Al Pacino or, more realistically, an anthropology professor. But more often than not, destiny intervenes and sets us on a path. Andy's ready to share what he's learned along the way, providing lessons and some delicious recipes on how he became the cook he wanted to be. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having me.
So, of course, I have to start by asking you what your favorite Al Pacino movie is.
I would probably have to say Serpico followed by Dog Day Afternoon. I mean, I'm a pretty big Al Pacino fan, I have to admit. It wasn't just for the book.
I assumed it was for real. You say that you never set out to be a cook, yet here you are. Tell us a little bit about your journey and how your cooking style kind of revealed itself.
I didn't necessarily plan to be a cook. My beginnings of my relationship with food started like so many others. I think it was the act of eating and the pleasure that these foods brought to me as an adolescent. But I think as I kind of got older, probably around 11, 12, I became a lot more curious beyond the idea of just the act of consumption and eating, but really the act of cooking and how it extends to bringing all these ingredients together, applying some technique, and something beautiful can happen. In addition to that, all the kind of cultures that can connect to it. And I was just so curious about all the kind of people's places that food and cooking could take me to.
You were given advice to go to college instead of culinary school and instead work your way up in restaurants. How did that work for you? Do you think that was good advice?
It was great advice for me. It was actually said by Cal Petronell. He was the co-chef at Chez Panisse for many, many years. He told me that when I was in my early days at Chez Panisse. He said, don't go to culinary school, work your way up in restaurants. And it was incredible advice because it really allowed me to absorb this kind of education that went beyond the kitchen. I really kind of just, I developed a skill that was beyond cooking. And I think a big part of that was working my way through restaurants around the country.
Yeah, it's so true. What is your first rule when it comes to cooking?
Probably the most important rule for me is to not strive for consistency, which probably goes against a lot of other people's rules. The lack of consistency, the idea of changing things up, changing the ingredients, changing your technique, changing your flavors is so essential for me as a cook because it allows me to constantly evolve. I try to kind of encourage the reader and the home cook to do just that as well.
And the variation, I think, is so human. Aspiring to something that is invariable, that never changes, is so antithetical to the human hand.
Absolutely. I think it was, it took the longest time for me to really absorb this rule and apply it to my own life in and out of the kitchen. I definitely think it's the most important.
We've all been talking a lot about snacks. What are some of your favorites?
One of my favorite snacks is actually something that I grew up with. In Persian, it's nuno panir, which means bread and cheese. I typically see it with barbari bread, which is a Persian flatbread that's topped with nigella seeds and sesame seeds. You'll have that with feta cheese, a platter of raw herbs and radishes, and then you combine all these things to make the perfect, in Farsi you say, lorme, which is, it translates to kind of the perfect bite. So I have a variation on that in the book, which is sliced feta with sizzled mint, which is dried mint that gets bloomed in hot oil, and chopped walnuts and chilies, and then you serve that with flatbreads.
Oh, it sounds so good. You talk about this chicory salad that is one of your favorites from Estella in New York. And I think any of us who have had that salad would say the same thing. You say the salad changed your life.
It did change my life. It changed the way I cook. I've been lucky enough to work with some incredible cooks at some great restaurants. I tend to look to Chez Panisse, which was the first restaurant I worked at. It kind of ingrained a certain philosophy in how I approach the kitchen. And when I came to Estella, which was probably 3 weeks, maybe a month after I had first opened, I had to just unconsciously throw away any of the education I had in the past and start all over again.
So as we were heading into salad days, seasonally, what are you using now? And talk a bit about salads that you love to compose, because as Californians, we're salad people. What can I say?
Yes. Well, now that it's getting warmer, I'm using less chicory and bitter greens and looking for softer, more sweeter lettuces, mixed tiny greens. Obviously, I'm waiting to see some little gems. And I always love pairing that with some kind of creamy, zesty dressing. I have a variation on a ranch that's made with tahini that's just creamy enough. And then it's topped with all different kind of sprinkles, sesame, nigella, shallots, and plenty of herbs. It's kind of a wedge of sorts, but no blue cheese.
With a few ingredients, you can give a new twist to vegetables. Share with us how you use coconut to kind of jazz up some pretty common veg.
I will take coconut flakes. I tend to always have unsweetened coconut flakes. I like having control over the sweetness. And I look at it as this kind of toasty, nutty, fragrant texture that you can add. And it's something that now has become a go-to, whether I'm sprinkling some on roasted veg or even kind of putting on it on a braised meat or grilled fish. I tend to toast coconut flakes in a skillet just until it's kind of lightly blonde. But other times I will toast it with a little bit of ghee or oil and throw in some dried chili. So you have kind of a spicy coconut mixture to sprinkle on top. There's a dish in the vegetable chapter. It's a turmeric roasted cauliflower that has a spicy coconut gremolata. And you dress the cauliflower with oil and turmeric and grating garlic, the whole cauliflower.
Mm, so good. I want you to leave us with talking about cooking a whole fish. It's amazing to me that after all these years of social media, food sharing, and the millions of recipes that all of us have access to, and the countless hours of food television everyone has watched, that people are still so intimidated about cooking a whole fish.
I'm right there with you. I tend to eat seafood and vegetables more than meat. Not only is it cost-effective, it's just such a delicious way to eat and enjoy fish. I think if there's one big tip, or a few tips, I would say, I should give a few tips. If you want to grill a whole fish, now that we are getting into the warmer months, the first thing is making sure your grill is clean, and that's by preheating it and then kind of scrubbing it down. And then I like to slick it with some oil right when it's hot. And the fish itself, it's always easier to use a smaller fish. We're talking about a pound, pound and a half, 2 pounds. Nothing necessarily bigger than that if it's your kind of first go around at this. And then what I tend to do, which is like double insurance, is I slick the grates with oil, but I also slick the fish with oil. And then I throw it on the grill and I let that go, usually at a gentle medium heat, nothing too high. The skin is tend to be so delicate. And it will eventually, I promise you, the skin will release from the grates and you're just going to turn the fish and flip it away from you. I find that it's easiest. And I promise it'll be worth it.
Thank you so much, Andy. It's a lovely book and I'm so happy to have gotten to have this conversation with you.
Thank you so much, Evan. I really appreciate it. It means the world coming from you.
That was Andy Baragani. You'll find a recipe from his book, The Cook You Want to Be, on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we explore the cuisine of sub-Saharan Africa. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Photographer Aileen Prinsett reminds us that cooking, like a piece of music, can transport us to a time and place. It can conjure childhood memories or release long-held emotions. Hoping to capture images and bring together African artists to celebrate their heritage, she needed a chef to set the table. Enter Anto Kokanya. Together, the two have created a stunning book, Saka Saka, South of the Sahara, Adventures in African Cooking.
Anto, tell us a bit about your culinary journey.
I grew up in Gabon. Gabon, it's a little country in the center of Africa. I started cooking very early. I was 9 years old. In many African cultures, a well-bred girl is a girl who can cook. And in addition, girls are educated to be future mistresses of the house. And cooking is one of the tasks they must know how to master. So for me, cooking was more than a household task. And I remember when I told to my father that I want to become a cook, he was really disappointed. In many countries in Africa, to be a cook is not a very ambitious job. I was about 15. I told him, oh, Dad, you know, with kitchen, I will be rich and famous. I will write books that will be published all over the world. And he didn't take me really serious. I have a doctor brother. My little sister is an engineer. I have another brother who is an accountant. So you see, in the culture in which I grew up, we are encouraged to do very intellectual jobs. And after my degree, my parents agreed to let me pursue my dreams of becoming a chef in France. And I trained in French table art, French cuisine, even did a university exchange program in the US to improve my English. And after 8 years of studies abroad, I decided to return to Gabon to work. But the return was difficult. I couldn't find a job despite my degrees. That time, getting into positions of responsibility in a kitchen when you are a woman was difficult, almost impossible. So I came back in France. I worked as a chef. And in 2016, when I had my sons, I didn't like the pace of work in the kitchen. So I quit my job and I create my own job as a private chef. And today I specialize in African cuisine. My cuisine is a Pan-African. I decided not to put forward a country, but rather products. First of all, because our country's borders were not set by us. And before we had kingdoms and empires in Africa that were dislocated with slavery and colonization, which is why in many borders countries we speak the same language, we share the same surnames, and we cook in the same way. So for me, it was more logical to highlight the products that bring us together rather than talk about country that divide us.
This book is stunning. It's rare to see a book just as absolutely beautiful as this book is.
Oh, thank you. And I think that one of the secrets of that is Isabelle. Isabelle was a culinary stylist. The publisher told me, you're going to write the receipt, but it's not you who's going to cook the receipt for the book. And Isabelle is French, and she didn't know African food.
That must have been kind of terrifying for you.
Yes, it was terrifying, but it was also a test to know that if someone who never, ever cooked something African, is it possible for this person to realize my receipt? And Isabelle, she did it. She did it. And even the way she put the food on a plate, the decor, it was like, Isabelle, are you sure that you didn't know African cuisine?
Let's get into the cuisine. Can you tell us what the four bases are for cooking African food and how each of them are used?
Yeah. The four bases. I traveled a lot and I realized that in the most of African countries, we have the same way to season our food. It's to make this paste of a blend of spices, herbs, onion, garlic. It's called nokos in Senegal. I made three different nokos, one for fish, one for meat, and one for vegetables or people who want to eat vegan.
Can you talk a little bit about the distinctions that you make between African cuisine, the cuisines of Africa, and sub-Saharan cuisine?
So African cuisines, for me, it's about all the five regional zone of Africa. So the north, west, and center, and south. When we talk about sub-Saharan, it's after the Sahara. For me, it's really different because the cuisine of North Africa, it's well known because of Morocco and Algeria, Egypt. But in sub-Saharan part of Africa, a lot of Europeans are afraid of this part because in the TV, it's only talk about wars, poverty, children who don't eat. So I think that the sub-Saharan African cuisine is the last gastronomy to discover in these years.
I would love if you would pick a dish from the book that you really would love us to make. Where should we start?
For me, it's going to be cassava and prawn fritters, because cassava is my favorite product. In Africa, we make everything with cassava. We have some flours, we have some couscous, we have semolina, we have a lot of things with cassava. For me, this recipe, I had it from my grandmother. It's one of the first recipes I began to cook with her. And this recipe, we can cook it in the salty way or sweet ways. It's really simple and the ingredients are easy to find.
And it's beautiful. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Anto. And the book is something really, really quite special.
Thank you.
Anto Kokanya is a French-trained chef from Gabon. We've been discussing the cuisines of Africa and the cookbook she wrote with photographer Aline Princet. It's Saka Saka, South of the Sahara, Adventures in African Cooking. No one is closer to the front lines of this pandemic than Melvin Blanco. He's an essential worker twice over. He's an oncology nurse at Kaiser Permanente in Panama City, and he's the owner of Juan and Nita's Bagnet Sea Log. He opened the Filipino restaurant in the Santa Clarita Valley in the midst of the pandemic, and he's made it a practice to feed frontline workers, such as doctors, nurses, firefighters, police officers, and even clergy, for free. He talks to us for this week's In the Weeds.
My name is Melvin Blanco, and I'm the owner of Juan and Nita's Bagnet Sea Log. Before I became a restaurant owner, I'm still working as a registered nurse at Kaiser Panorama Hospital. Juan Nita's Bagnet Sea Log opened October 24 because of the pandemic. The grand opening postponed several times. It's named after my parents. Juan is my father and Nita is my mother. Bagnet Sea Log, I combine the words. Bagnet means pork belly, a special pork belly method of cooking. And then the Sea Log means breakfast or meals. Even though in such a young age, I thought of having a restaurant. My mother actually, the one that inspired me, I remember when I was young, 11 to 12 years old, I used to come with her and take me delivering food to different places and locations in Manila, specifically called Ocan City. That's where I used to live. And that started me thinking that one of these days I would own and have my own restaurant in the future. My mother usually cooked for every occasion that we have. And she loves feeding a large gathering, like when we have celebrations and special occasions. And she is so passionate about cooking. And she taught each one of us, my siblings, sisters and brothers, how to cook and present to us her own technique and how to cook dishes in the Philippines. When I moved here in the U.S., 1990, I loved cooking for my friends and family. It's in the blood. My first job in the food industry is when I graduated in high school in the Philippines. I worked in this company named Jollibee, and I worked there for almost 2 years, and I learned a lot from that place, how to manage my time when it comes from cooking and how to organize things when it comes from the ingredients. I used to live with my sister when I came over here in San Diego, so my first job here is to work at Wendy's. I got into the healthcare when I was here. Actually, it was not my priority when it comes from having my professional career. I wanted to become an architect in the Philippines, but when I came over here, my dad talked to me about, why don't you follow your sister's footsteps and be a nurse too? And then I did that, and I was glad I did it, because at that moment of time when my dad was sick for having a lung cancer, I'd be able to understand what my dad was going through, and yeah, able to help my dad too. Ever since, before I even start my restaurant, I always think about Boodle Fees, and it has a special part in my heart because I know most of the Filipinos traditionally enjoy having meals together along with the family and loved ones. So I said when I put up a restaurant, I would definitely put this in my menu. Basically, budol fish is a different kind of dishes, adobo dish with soup, tinola, pork belly fried, crispy pata, all together in one big tray. I kind of improvise a big tray and create that big tray that I could serve the budol fish. And people could ask me or request for any kind of dish that they want, and then I could put them all together there. Traditionally, when you eat on a budol fish, you use your hands. Back in the day, in the Philippines, Second World War, people in Manila or in the province, they do that to have a feast and share the food and eat it with their hands. Now, of course, here when I serve it in my restaurant, we use utensils, plates. But it's just basically all together food, different kinds, 12 to 15 dishes, and gather together and have a feast with those dishes. When it was in the middle of pandemic on 2020, since I was closed for 7 or 8 months, and I was thinking, we're closed as a quarantine, what else can we do to help out our frontliners? So what I did was I talked to my people from the restaurant and family from church, if they can help me, and my chef as well, Jake, if they can help me to put individual meals, mostly silog. The silog is all together with egg, rice, chicken or beef or fish, and then individually serve each hospital that we want to give food to for the frontliners. 7 or 8 hospitals we deliver for frontliners so they can have the meals fresh, warm, without anything in return. The food in the dish of the Filipino restaurant owner is being known now. Unlike before, it's not very out there. Now it's getting more exposure. Other people are trying and they get a chance to taste it. And as soon as they taste it and tried it, they'll be able to like it. And it's a delicious dish. My meat special is the bagnet, which is the pork belly that's been cooked overnight to make it tender. And then when people order, we deep fried it 5 to 6 minutes and it becomes crispy outside and tender inside. I don't usually serve a traditional Filipino. What I did was to modify some of the dish, like the adobo. What I did is just add shiitake mushroom along with it, and bagnet pork belly. I mix it with organic baby broccoli as well, and some sesame seeds, and with a little bit of oyster and hoisin on the dish. I have a dessert that is very typical with Filipino. We call it lechuplan. But what I did with my lechuplan is I put in a bagnet bits cut into pieces and poured it on top of the lechuplan along with the pistachio nuts. And also I have a jumbo fried squid. It's calamari style kind of cooking. But what I did, I don't cut it into pieces. I cook it with breaded squid, deep fried it, and I let it stand with a metal skewer and have a wooden stand. And you would like not just the taste, but the presentation itself. People loves it and they take pictures of it. If you come today and order my halo-halo, which is part of the dessert in the Philippines also, it's delicious, sweet, and a very good dessert. And the main thing really is my bagnet, which is delicious, and you will truly enjoy it.
That was Melvin Blanco, owner and founder of Juan and Nita's Bagnet Silog in Canyon Country. It's open every day except Tuesday for dine-in and takeout. To learn more about the restaurant, visit our website at kcrw.com/goodfood.
Up next, it is go-go time for mangoes. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the farmer's market, where Jillian Ferguson has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. It's that time of year when a very special fruit shows up at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Mangoes from the desert are here for just a short window, and once again, we turn to the chef community for ideas on what to do with a special ingredient. I'm talking with Victor Munoz, chef at Conservatory in West Hollywood today. Hi, Victor.
Hi, Jillian. How are you?
I'm good. So I know that you were as excited about these Valencia Pride mangoes as I was when I saw them show up.
You know what? I love this mango. I believe it's a little bit more sweeter than usual, and I love to what you can do with them. There's so many things, from pickling to juicing them, gazpachos. I mean, there's so much texture in these mangoes and acidity, but at the same time, it all balances out with that sweetness that it's phenomenal.
That's so interesting. So you were kind of leaning towards more savory applications there. Give us a few ideas for putting them in our savory dishes.
Yeah, for sure. So what I actually am doing at Conservatory is because they're so sweet, I needed to balance them out. And we're making a gazpacho with them. We're actually using the skin because it's a little bit on the sour side. We dehydrate it with a little bit of citric acid and chili flakes. And then we add it to the mango after it's juiced. And then afterwards, we grab the seed of the mango. We go ahead and burn it so it gets char. And then we shave it to that same concoction. And then add a little bit of, you know, alliums, cucumber. But it just brings out this flavorful mango profile that you can't get with any mango that you're getting at the store. I mean, the Valencia Prides are phenomenal.
Wow, that is amazing. You are using every single part of the mango.
Yeah, we're trying to use as much as we can in our produce. You know, we're trying to be as sustainable as we can. We're trying to, you know, make sure that we do our part to not have, you know, to reduce our carbon footprint. And this, I mean, the mangoes is one of those things that you just have to use everything because everything is edible, you know, in my hometown, in my country. Like you eat this, the skin, you know, you don't do anything with the seed. So we figure, hey, let's find out what happens. And through trial and error, we found out that it has this amazing, like, acidic nuttiness flavor. And it just so happened that it works well in the gazpacho.
That is incredible. So how do you plate the gazpacho at the restaurant?
So at the restaurant, we're using soft-shell crabs right now that they're in season. And we make a flour with mango sashimi. We coat it. We then pan fry it. Underneath, we use Dungeness crab that we turn into a salad with mango pieces, a little of avocado, tomato. And then table side, we fold in the mango gazpacho.
You know, these are such sort of chef-y ideas, which are so fun to think about. What do you think is the most accessible thing that home cooks can do aside from just eating these mangoes over the sink?
Honestly, there's so many things that a home cook can do from, you know, from pickling the, you know, a mango, putting in a salad, using them. I think we don't juice mangoes enough. I mean, we should. It's such a complex, you know, sweet flavor that can go in so many applications. And I think we just gotta, you know, go to trial and error. Don't be scared to play around with your food. It's okay.
That was Victor Munoz, the chef at Conservatory in West Hollywood. We've been talking about all the ways he uses Wong Farms mangoes. Jason Chamberlain is the farmer bringing these Valencia Pride mangoes to the market. Now you're at the height of mango season. Tell us a little bit about this year's crop.
So this year, our crop is doing really good. The one that we have right now is the Valencia Pride. It's still a pretty short season of 4 to 5 weeks, and we're week two right now.
When I think of mangoes, I tend to think of tropical climates. Is it pretty unique to grow them in the desert?
Yes. So we've tried a couple different varieties to get to where we're at. The Valencia Pride likes a lot of heat, a lot of sun, and it has a lot of foliage to manage that.
And whose idea was it to grow these mangoes where you are?
My grandfather. He started planting mango trees in 1998. He started with 12 different varieties. He ended up with the Valencia Pride in the kit.
Describe the Valencia Pride's flavor for us.
So the Valencia Pride has a really sweet pineapple peach flavor, and it sometimes has a coconut kind of notes to it. Mm-hmm.
I gave one to a friend, and she loved it so much that she tried to plant it. And I was curious, will that actually work? Do you have to graft mango trees, or can you plant them from seed?
So you have to graft the Valencia Pride. So they're all grafted from one tree in from our orchard. If you do it from seed, it's monoembryonic. So you'll either get a hybrid of the Valencias or some type of the parent tree.
Okay. Okay. I do see them occasionally growing in Los Angeles backyards, mango trees. Are they difficult to cultivate? Your face says it all.
So it depends on how hands-on you are with your tree. When they're younger, they need a little more attention. When it's developed enough roots, then it's a little easier to manage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a rough start, but then easier as it goes.
Kind of like child rearing.
Exactly.
And when you bring them here to the market, they come in sort of a range of colors. You bring super ripe and yellow, some green, some have red spots. Explain the colors to us.
So when fully ripe, the mango should have a full yellow color, almost a gold yellow. The red blush is usually from sun exposure and doesn't really determine if it's ripe or not. The green, just less ripe. And some people like it less ripe if they want more of a firm or crunchy mango, where when it's fully ripe, it has more of a custardy texture.
Oh, that texture is just unbelievable. And how do you like to pick them when you're picking off the trees?
So when we're picking it, we're looking for 25 or 50% color, and it's more of the darker yellow coloring, not the pale yellow.
Okay. And so if we pick one up at the market from you, and let's say it has a mix of those colors, some light yellow, maybe a little green, what should we do when we get home?
So just put it on the counter in the kitchen, wait till it fully turns yellow.
Okay. And how much longer do we get these?
2 to 3 weeks.
So quick.
Yeah, very quick. And then mid to late August, we should have our next variety called Kit. They're a darker green variety, but orange inside, more of a brown sugar citrus flavor.
Can't go wrong either way. Okay, well, Jason, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Jason Chamberlain of Wong Farms. It's peak season for their Valencia Pride mangoes. You can find them at the Wednesday Santa Monica, Saturday Pasadena, and Sunday Hollywood Farmers Markets. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can always subscribe on any podcast app like Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Jillian Ferguson, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Chrissy Van Meter, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Gary Masiha, and Sean L. Mallon. I'm Evan Kleinman. The very first Russian dish I learned to cook as a child was beef stroganoff. For many years, it was the meal I always requested on my birthday, and I have such a powerful sense memory of that dish that if my mother deviated from the recipe even a tiny bit, well, I just couldn't handle it. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.